of the last discourse Jesus has with the disciples before he dies. And it starts at the supper that he has where he's already washed his disciples' feet. Of course, he asks them the question, do you know what I just did? And the answer is not, you washed our feet. The answer is, I gave you an example of service. If the greater is going to serve the lesser, then you ought to do that yourself. And that leads us to this new commandment, which has been called the badge of discipleship. And our last class, we introduced it, and so we just want to finish that discussion. And it's this this new commandment, which he says is about love. So there's where we're going to start in verse 34 and get through the end of that chapter, and then we'll see his exhortation to his disciples not to be fearful. So when we look at this new commandment, we've all heard it perhaps before, and let me get to it right here. It's very similar to what God's already said, so we're going to have to ask, why is it a new commandment? But if we read it, he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you should love one another just as I loved you, and that you should also love one another. By this, I'm in verse 35, all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So let me ask the first question. Where do we first read something similar like this, this command? The what? The Old Testament, we see that. We're supposed to love our neighbor. We're supposed to love the foreigner. And then when Jesus was asked some questions about the greatest commandment, what was the response there? The greatest is to love God. And the second is love your neighbor. You know, and so why is this new? He says it's a new commandment, does he not? Yes, Kelly.
Because before it was to love your neighbor as yourself.
All right. All right, if you didn't hear that, the first standard and by which you're going to love someone is, will you treat them or love them the way you'd want to be treated and loved? And that's the, i.e., the golden rule. Jesus raises the bar when he says, I want you to love one another just the way I have loved you. Now, there, if you look at that there, do they understand at this time the extent in which he is going to love them? And the answer is obviously no. Babeto, why?
Because he hasn't died on the cross.
He hasn't died yet, and they don't expect him to die. They're going to be shocked and dismayed when he does die because they don't understand why. But it's afterwards, when it's all said and done, after the resurrection, we can look back. We understand why he died. And so look with me in 1 John chapter 4. Of course, it's not just by coincidence. John writes this little letter. It's called, you know, it's all about the love, you know, of God. But in 1 John chapter 3, in verse 16, we know love by this. So here we're going to have an understanding of what real love is. And he says, he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Now, what passage does that remind you of in the Gospel of John? I'm going to find it. It has a 3:16 too. Just that's your first clue. I'm sorry? Well, that's not the one I'm thinking of, but yeah. That's right. John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Here we have 1 John 3:16, right? And it says, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and so we ought to do the same. So John 3:16 is the model for what real true love is. God so loved that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes on him should not perish. And there's our working definition of love. And we'll rehearse it because you're going to keep hearing it. Because the world doesn't know what love is. Because everyone says, all that matters is love. All the world needs is love. The Beatles sing love, 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 right? And so what is, though, love? True love. Well, John 3:16 tells us what true love is. Love is an attitude. God so loved the world. It's directed towards someone. You can't just say you love without loving somebody. I mean, let's just clear that up. If you don't love someone, you do not love, okay? God so loved the world that he... So what's the next thing we learn about this attitude of love? It always causes you to act, to do something. So let's just clear that up. If you say you love someone, and when they're in need and need help, and you don't do anything, can you say you love them?
No,
you're lying and deceiving yourself. Because the standard of godly love is an attitude that you regard someone important enough that when they need help, you do something. If you have the ability, right? That's all it is. So God so loved the world that he gave what? So what do we learn there?
He gave it all.
Yeah, he gave it all. And it's sacrificial. It cost him something. It's not just his son, it's his only son. You know, why would God do that? I mean, when you say, well, because he loves us. But that still doesn't answer the question. Why would he do that? Why does he love me that much? The only thing you can say is, thank you, Lord. I don't understand why you would love me. And if you dare answer it, okay, you get a medal, because I don't know why God would love you.
Because God is love.
That was a joke. No, God.
Because God is love.
But why would he love
it's
you?
His nature. It's who he is.
But anyway, it doesn't answer the question. But I'm asking why.
I just gave you one.
Huh?
Because he chose to.
The only answer is just what you're saying is it's just because he does. He does.
We can't argue.
We are so important to him that he would give his only son. And you go, well, why? I just don't feel that important. I don't feel that worthy. Doesn't matter. When you understand and believe in his love, you realize I have an extreme value to God, right? That's the only answer you can give. You know, he just does. You're right in what you're saying. That's who he is. I can't answer why. Because he wants to. He chose to. We're that important.
Well, he tested that love too with Abraham and Isaac. And he wanted to see if he was willing to go to that.
Well, that's love coming back.
Yeah, that's
right.
Love coming back. And
we're talking about his love for us, though.
That they were willing to sacrifice.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying. He required of himself what he did not ask Abraham to go through with.
Yeah.
All right? But so God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him should not perish. So here's the real working definition of love. It's an attitude held towards another that causes you to act in their best interest so they should not perish but have eternal life. So do you help someone that needs no help? Is that love? No, that's blessing someone, right? You understand maybe the difference? Love is helping someone that needs help, that can't help themselves. You're acting in their best interest. And it's always free, right? Because if he gave it, is there any charge? No. And so if you ask something in return, you're not helping them, you're selling them something, right? So love is an attitude held towards another that causes you to act sacrificially and freely in their behalf. Now, the big question is, who gets to determine what's in someone's best interest? That's the big question. And it goes back to what Kelly said. The standard used to be love one another as you would love yourself. Now it's as Christ loved you. He gets to set the standard. He'll tell us. Now, with that being said, we know love by this. That he what? Laid down his life. And then here's the big word in John 3:16. So we ought to lay down our life for the brethren. Ought implies what?
Should.
But it's even stronger than should. It's your oblige or obligation. Must. You're indebted to. Indebted to because of what? What he first did for you, it's only fair and reasonable now you do it for others. All right. So, Marvin.
Can you go into a little more depth about laying down of your life? Because I'm a little confused about that.
All right. That's what I was just going to do. That's why I sighed. Okay. He asked, can you go into more depth about what it means to lay down your life? Because this is how we know what love is. And Jesus said, that's the greatest commandment. A lot of times people ask that question, well, what does it mean to lay down my life? How? To what extent? What do I got to do? Now, to be fair, some people ask that question because they truly just want to know. What does that mean? Other people ask that question because they want to know the limits that they have to go to, actually the minimum. So they don't want to exceed that because it's hard loving others, especially when you don't care about others. So sometimes some people, and I'm not accusing anyone here, but ask that question because they want to know, well, man, I want to be a disciple of Christ. I want to keep the new commandment. So what are the limits? I mean, what's the bare minimum that I have to do to lay down my life? Well, if that's the motivation for asking that question, I cannot give you a proper answer because whatever I do, you're looking for works, right, rather than love. But if you're asking because what does it mean to lay down your life? Because I want to do it, because I want to be like Christ, and I want to be his disciple, then we can answer the question, and you'll receive the answer. Okay, do you see the difference? All right. Right, exactly. So, with that being said, that's why Christ laid down his life, because he did regard us more important than himself. But this phrase here, laid down his life, what does that mean? What did he do? What is it pointing to?
He sacrificed.
To the cross, and it's talking about he died. It's talking about his death. So we ought to lay down our life. What is the ultimate expression of you loving someone else? When you would die for them. Now, why would you die for them? Thankfully, there's very rarely any type of circumstance that would ask you to die for someone else. But can you imagine one? Someone give me one that's legitimate.
Huh? Serve the military.
All right, serve the military. You're loving, you're giving your life sacrificially for someone else. Yes. Parents taking or giving up their life for their children, you know, and that's happened. I remember this news story. A guy shoved his child out of the way of an oncoming car and then died himself. All right. Yes. All right. All right. So he said in the mission field are people preaching and end up in really scary places where they end up losing their life or going to prison. All right. Yes.
I'm thinking of the mother who there's a decision to make. It's either the baby's going to live or you're going to live, but one or the other. And that has happened.
Yeah, that's true.
Gives up her life or her child.
All right. So if you were in. Right.
But Christ had said,
even your enemy.
While we were ungodly, he died for us. So that is a
that's
tall
right.
order.
If that's a good point.
It might not know. It might be somebody, you know, that doesn't live, you know.
Or people you don't even like or that they're your enemies. That's right. Good point. But the thing is that if you're willing to die for someone, would you be willing to do anything short of that? And the reason people aren't willing to do something short of dying is because they're not willing to die for them. So in other words, I can't give them my time. I can't give them my resources. I can't give them, you know, my money. I can't spend, you know, work with them with the gospel, because the reason they can't do that is because they don't get what real love is. They're not willing to lay down their life. Yes.
It's not just that you're willing to die for them, though, but it was the manner of death. The fact that at any time throughout that horrible, long ordeal, he could have changed his mind.
Yes.
It wasn't a split-second decision of, I'm going to die for you. He knew the whole time.
It was the whole plan.
It's harder for us to continue on in loving when it's not a manner of death.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's not just that split second, it's this continuing manner and attitude you have to continue.
So if I hear what you're saying, you correct me if I don't, you know, repeat it correctly. It'd be easier just to die for someone than love them every day for years and years when they just wear you out. Is that, yeah, okay. I understand. That's it, doesn't it? And that's why he says, don't grow weary in well-doing, because you will reap if you don't give up. Because it's, you get tired of helping, helping, and helping, all right? So the maximum is everything. That's the sign of true discipleship, because disciples follow Christ to learn from Christ. They're learning from Christ so they can live like Christ and be just like him. So the badge of discipleship is when you love others freely and willingly with joy in your heart, because you know they are so important. God's taking care of you, so you want to help take care of others. Now, here's the problem when you set the standard, though, of what's in someone's best interest. Because we got the maximum. It's, you know, I'll do whatever God asked me to do, whatever is best for you. But what is best? Who's the only one who gets to determine that? We have to go back to Christ, because he says, as I loved you. Because there's sometimes he said no, and there's sometimes he said yes. There's sometimes he rebuked people, and there's sometimes, you know, he blessed people. So when it comes to like someone that needs food or help or clothing, it's interesting. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but you could read 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6, where it says, Paul says, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you. So where is this coming from? To withdraw yourselves from those that walk not according to tradition which we have given you. And he says, if a man won't work, what? Don't let him eat. You mean let him go hungry? Yes. Now, where does this come from? Not from Paul. Where does it come from? Jesus. Now, let me ask you this. If he says a guy is able to work, has the opportunity to work, but refuses to work, you don't feed him when he comes to you asking for food, is that loving or not?
Yes.
Now, why do you say yes, whether you understand why or not? Because it comes from who? Jesus. Does that make sense? He understands that if you feed them when they refuse to take care of their own needs, you're not loving them, you're actually hurting them. Well, we're now going to start asking the wisdom behind it, and we're going to come up with answers like that. That's right, we're enabling them. We're creating a dependency. You know, they're becoming a taker and a user rather than a giver, and that's never appropriate. But even if we don't understand why, can we trust him when he says, don't, that's the loving thing to do? Can we trust him? So sometimes it's not in us, all of us, to know what the loving thing to do is. Like, should I help this guy or not? Go to God's word. He sets the standard, whether we understand it or not, okay? So, but we have to have the spirit and the willingness that we're moved by what he did for us, that I have this inward obligation. It's a debt that I just have inside me, and it just speaks to me always that I got to love others. I just have to. I'm passionate about it. Not because I have to, but because I have to. Do you see the difference? One's external. Okay, if I have to. The other one's, I just got to do this because that's who I am now because of what he's done for me. See the difference? And that's the badge of discipleship. Isn't that what set Christians apart? We're up in, last week in Kirkland, and I guess they did a collection just for some of the brethren Christians in Houston, raised $9,000 just on a Sunday. and they're going to give more later. And they announced, you know, how much they raised. And I know we did that. We raised money here for some of those hurricane relief people. And I think it's a good idea, you know, the elders think about it. We should announce to the congregation what they did. So people know, wow, that's very generous, because it models for others who didn't. Wow, maybe I should be thinking about that. Because some of those people sacrificed or lost everything, didn't they? While we're living in our nice homes, is it okay to be sacrificial for them? People we don't know. That's right. And so that's an example of it. See? It's still going on there in Houston, isn't it? It's going to take months for recovery. I'm not even talking about Puerto Rico, where the whole island is just not a tree left. All right? So, any questions about this? All right. So when we look at it, those are some examples. This is kind of interesting. We'll finish chapter 13. Peter asked him, he said, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus comes back and says, well, where I'm going, you can't follow me, but you'll follow later. Peter said, Lord, why can't I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you. Now, I gotta love Peter. He's the one asking, okay, Lord, you tell us you're going, where are you going? He says, well, where I'm going, that's to the cross and to heaven. You can come, but you'll follow later. And then what does he come back? I don't want to put inflections in his voice that were not there, but it sounds like, Lord, why can't I come with you? I want to go. I'll go wherever you go. I'll lay down my life for you. Does that sound like Peter? You know, and is that a good heart? Do you want Peter saying that? Do you want him to say and vow faithfulness and dedication? I'll die for you. Do you want him to say that? Well, if you said, no, he should know that's not really him and he's going to deny him Christ, well, then you're going to have him say, well, Lord, I might follow you. I might die for you. No, you want to hear that commitment. We smile because we know Peter, don't we? He's always the one that's going to voice his commitment. And he's the one that fell so far, denied him three times. And that's what we're seeing here. But that's the right attitude. But sometimes our faithfulness grows through our trials, doesn't it? Because Peter is young here. And I say young in the faith, but he grows and becomes stronger and stronger. So Jesus' answer said, will you lay down your life for me? He challenges him. And you know, that's a good way to look at ourselves in the mirror. And we say, well, I love others. Do you really love others? Would you really lay down your life for others? Well, certainly. Would you? That's what he's doing. Truly, I say, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times. Now, he's speaking, of course, of the denial that took place later. Now, we know Peter said, no, I won't. And all the other disciples said the same, right? We'll die for you. But when it came, what happened? They scattered. They ran, you know, as fast as they could. So that's the end of John 13. I really want to get through this first section of John. So, but any questions right there? So open your Bible to John 14. Now, who has a red letter Bible? Raise your hand. All right. Red letter means what? All right. Thank you, publishers, because when I was really young, one of the first questions you ask when you're doing a Bible study is, who's speaking, right? Because sometimes ungodly people are being quoted in the Bible, right? They're speaking. Do you want to follow them? Well, of course not. And it really is helpful when you see the words of Jesus because, well, then, of course, you know it's that he's the one that's talking. Now, when you open your Bible and it's a red letter Bible and you look to John 14, you look at John 15, and you look John 16, and then pretty much all the way through 17, what is every page colored in?
Red.
Red. So this is the longest discourse that we have of Jesus in the Bible. In fact, we saw that in the book of John, the last week of his life takes up half the gospel. The events that take place. It starts in John 12, goes all the way through 21. And so here we're going to read his last words, really, with the 12, minus one, because who is left already? Judas has already left, correct? So If you knew that you were going to die, and you've called these men who've left their families, left their business, and have followed you for 3 years, every day, have eaten with you, have labored with you, has slept with you, have struggled with you, has cried with you, and now you're going to tell them, I'm leaving. Do you think that would upset them? It would. And so what would you say before you left? Especially you know that in just a few days, you're going to die and they're just going to be devastated because that's the last thing they expect. So how are you going to prep them for that? What are you going to say? I guess it's sort of like some of us knew that we're going to pass from this earth. We're going to die. What would be the last thing you say to your children? What would be the last thing you say to the congregation, your brethren, to your wife or to your husband? Huh?
I love you.
Yeah. Well, these words are very poignant and they're very informative and they're very helpful. And they're all given to the disciples to give them some foundation to rest upon because they know it's going to be troubling in the days ahead, all right? So that's John 14 through 16. In this first section, Jesus is going to basically say, I'm leaving, I'm going to prepare a place for you, but I'm coming back. But until I do, I'm going to send you a helper, so I won't leave you alone. So that's encouraging. But it starts with the bad words, I am leaving. So we look in John 14. He begins this way, do not let your heart be troubled. We've seen those words already where Jesus used them to speak of himself. John chapter 11, it says when Lazarus had died and everyone's weeping, it says Jesus was troubled in his spirit. That word means agitated, just torn back to and fro inside. There's this inner emotional turmoil. We saw it also in John chapter 12 and again in John 13. He's troubled. It speaks again of his humanity. Not conflict, but just his humanity. He cared for people, but he knows what he has to do. And now he realizes when he dies, his disciples are going to be devastated. So he says, don't be troubled. Well, what do you mean, Lord? It's like me coming home and saying, Ann, I got some bad news. Are you sitting down? I don't want you to be overly concerned. She's, oh, no, what happened? You think about the kids, an accident, something, right? You always think the worst when you hear that kind of introduction. And that's where he starts here. He says, you believe in God. They go, yeah, that's right. I want you to believe in me. Now, that's powerful. Because it says a lot. He's putting himself what? On the same level and the plane as God himself. All right? Now, when we look at that word, pistuo, it means to believe. That's the Greek word, and I want you to feel familiar with it more. Because we sometimes think because in English we use the word believe and faith, that they're two different Greek words. They're all the same word. One's a verb form, one's a noun form. So let me ask you this. Do these disciples believe in Jesus? Yes. They believe in him. Well, what did Peter already do? When he said, who do you say that I am? He said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Do they believe in Jesus?
Yes.
So why did he say, believe in me?
Because there's going to be some trials coming.
But why tell them to do what they already do?
Really tough.
Yeah, we're missing something, though. Yes?
They believe, but they don't really understand all of it.
They don't understand and comprehend. All right. And?
I think that's the hardest thing is that it's going to be trust. And here's the hard thing for a human being is trusting something you don't understand.
All right.
We are basically wired to trust after we understand and have all the facts. Here Jesus is asking us to do something really outside of ourselves.
All right.
We have to trust and we don't understand.
All right. So, the Bible word for faith has three elements to it. And you look up even in the Greek dictionary, Bible words, it'll say definition number one, to agree, to believe in something, to have mental assent. I agree, Jesus is the Son of God. Now, we already read in John chapter 12 that many of the rulers believed in him, but were not willing to confess him for fear of the Pharisees, because they already said whoever confessed him would be put out of the synagogue. So they loved the approval of men rather than God. Did they trust Jesus? Did they believe in him? See, they thought the approval of men would do more for them than Jesus Christ, the creator of everything. So faith starts in the head. It's very reasonable. Jesus said in John chapter 10, and we're going to see it again here in John 14, don't believe because I told you. Believe why? Not because I told you, because I showed you. Believe because of the works, the miracles. They testify to who I am. If I didn't do the works, he said in John chapter 10, don't believe that I am the Christ. Does that make sense? So he's arguing for evidence and logic. You have to come to a conclusion mentally. Is Jesus who he said he was? Now, once you believe he is the Son of God, will you trust him? Yes. See, that's the second part of faith, where a lot of time your faith gets stuck in your throat. It won't move from your head to your heart. And we talked about that again last Sunday night, and you talked about it. But it has to involve your very being, because this makes sense. Sometimes trusting you doesn't make sense. This is where we walk by faith and not by sight, like Peter walking on the water. Did that make any sense scientifically, laws of physics and all that? Did it make any sense? No. Did it make a lot of spiritual sense?
Yes.
Why?
Because it showed trust.
Why did it make sense, though, to trust him?
Because he has shown them time and time and again.
Because he's walking on the water. He's Lord of all. And he said what to Peter?
Come.
So I trust you. Doesn't make any sense, but I trust you. I don't need to understand. I trust you. And he was all good until what? He stopped trusting and started thinking, I can't be doing this. I'm walking on water. This is stupid. And what happened? Right? So the word here, when he says believe in me, he's not zeroing in on the mental aspect. He's zeroing in on the trust aspect. You trust in God. Please trust in me. It's an imperative. He's commanding them to do it. But we have to choose to.
For 3 years, all the signs in which Jesus performed in front of his disciples.
Yeah.
Everything that he did, they doubted. They doubted time and time and time again. Even the feeding of the 5,000. Where are we going to come up with this? And Jesus showed them. Now he's
instilling
that into them. After all that I've shown you, now believe in me, what I am telling you.
That's right. And he said even there, he says, you get food for him. And he said this because he was testing them to see if they would trust him. All right, so we go on. That's what he's saying. You all comfortable with that? Where's your biggest struggle? Believing that Jesus is the Christ or trusting with all your life?
Trusting.
Of course.
Trusting.
Huh? Trusting. It's trusting. That's our challenge every day. Will I trust him? Because anxiousness is a lack of, not of faith, but a lack of trust. So when Peter began to sink, what did Jesus say? Oh, ye of little faith. Because he wasn't trusting. See, faith means trust in this context, all right? So that's what we have to grow in. So Morrison writes this: his disciples felt his departure like a torture. I think it's very graphic, because when he says, I'm leaving. And that's the very next words. He says, in my Father's house, there's many dwelling places. The King James says mansions, and we'll talk about that in a second. And he said, if it were not so, I wouldn't tell you. But I go to prepare a place for you. Now, if I go to prepare a place for you, what's the promise? I'll come again. And I will receive you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know where I'm going. Now, is this challenging? Working backwards. Do they know where he's going? No. So do they know the way? Because they don't even know where he's going. So how are they going to know the way? And what do you mean you're coming back for us? Why are you leaving in the first place? And what do you mean you're making a place for us in the Father's house? All this is like, what are you doing now? Can you imagine how traumatic this would be? But we look back at it and says, this is the most comforting, most beautiful thing in the world. And it is. And we sing songs, you know, about, I've got a mansion, right? So let's look at it and break it down. He said, in my Father's house. First of all, does God have a house? Yes. It's not a physical house, because God cannot dwell in houses made by men. The temple was not his dwelling place, literally. He just looked upon it. But does he have a dwelling place? That's what Jesus said, all right? And the King James says, my Father's mansion, right? It's not, the word there is not a mansion. In the Greek word, it's a permanent dwelling place. And so really, to be true to the Greek, you can't say mansion. But if it's the Father's house, is it a mansion? So we're back to where we started. If it's our Father's house, is it a mansion for you and me? Yeah, I mean, you can't imagine. That's the Swanstein Castle there in Europe. And if you ever walk through it, like, man, this guy lived in royalty. You cannot imagine what our Father's house is going to be like. All right? Now, I don't remember how many hundreds of rooms this place has when we walk through it. But what does Jesus say? I'm going to go and what? For you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I'm going to come back to get you after I'm done. So that you can be with me where I am, and where's that? In my Father's house. Is this not comforting? And he says, you know the way. Now, to understand this, here's some bullet points. He said, there's much room, there's many room, place. Think about the millions of people, if not billions, are going to be in heaven. We say it's the few and the many, but when you take one half of 1% of all the people lived on the world, how many does that make? Zillions, all right? And this is a big place, and there's going to be room for everybody. And he said, I'm leaving, and I'm going to come again. And we have to understand the background of Jewish weddings. And when we do, this like comes alive. Jewish weddings are not like our weddings tradition at all. Where when you all got married, you fell in love with your prospective bride. I'm talking to you men then. You found the courage to ask her to marry you. And then you arranged some type of special event, you had the ring in your pocket, you got down on one knee, and you said, would you marry me? And by the virtue, the fact that your wife is sitting with you, I know she said yes, all right? She might have said no the first time, but eventually she said yes. You put the ring on her finger, and you are now what? Engaged. Are you married? No. Has some engagements been broken? Yeah, more than one. But finally, when the day of the wedding comes, you march down the aisle and you stand for a man and he takes a person and he takes your vows and you vow before God to take each other as your husband and wife and be faithful to them until death do you part. And that covenant now binds you in marriage. Then you go off and live together. All right, pretty much. Really different with the Jewish wedding. First of all, there's a betrothal. The prospective groom would leave his father's house and go to the bride's parents' house to talk to the father. And there would be some negotiation for the price of the bride. We would call it a dowry. But that was always expected. And once that price or amount was agreed upon, they would have a cup of blessing. It was a fruit of the vine. It's very important. What has Jesus just finished with the disciples? Drinking this cup, right? And once it was agreed upon, they're now betrothed, and contractually, they are married. They are in a covenant relationship. It's not like our engagement. You cannot break it without a bill of divorcement. You are married. The only difference is you don't live together yet. So that's the betrothal period after there's the covenant entered into, the cup of blessing, and then the groom leaves. I'll see you. Well, where are you going? Everyone knew where he's going, and so it was okay. He's going back to his father's house to build on to that place, a dwelling place, so he could come get his wife later and bring her back and have a place to live. And that's when they would start living as man and wife. Because it's not like us. When we get married, we just take off and get in our own home or new apartment, right? They would live with their family. It's a large extended family. So after this period of time, the groom would return. And usually the father would determine when it's ready to go get the bride. It was around a year, more or less. But when he would come back, there would be a great announcement. Now, the bride didn't know either. So she would always find herself what? The big word, ready. Would she keep herself pure during this year of betrothal? Yes, because she belongs to another man in covenant. And she will be as pure as she can because they're married. And when she doesn't know, she's always ready. But when the announcement comes, the bridegroom cometh, she prepares herself and goes out. And then she leaves with him. And he receives her and goes back to his father's house. And that's where they have the wedding feast, the great celebration. And now she lives with him forever on this earth as husband and wife. That happened time after time after time again. Do we see the exact same parallel right here? Because when you look at Jesus has come to this earth, who sent him? The Father. Was there a negotiation, a price for our souls? What was it? His blood. Did he enter into a covenant with us? That's right. We see in Jeremiah, and all the New Testament writers refer to it. You know, God's entered into a new covenant, not written on stone, but written in our hearts. We've been purchased with a price, with blood, the blood of his son. And that's why Paul says, I betrothed you to Christ as a pure virgin. And that's why in Ephesians chapter 5, he says, husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church, giving himself up for her, buying her, that she might be pure and holy. But we are in a contractual relationship with Christ. Now, has he left? Has he left? Where did he go? What did he say? I go to prepare a place for you at his father's house. And he says, I will come back. Now, when he was asked, when are you going to return? He said, only the Father knows, right? Didn't he say that? But I'll come, and it will be the shout of the archangel. He has to shout because everyone won't know when, but they'll know when he shouts, right? And the voice of the archangel and the trumpet sound. And since we are ready and we're pure, he's going to receive him up to heaven so we can live with him. And in Revelation talks about that great coming home, and Revelation talks about this great wedding feast that takes place. Isn't that what Jesus is saying? I'm going to come again and receive you to myself. Don't be troubled. You trust God. Trust me. I got this taken care of. All right. We'll stop there. Next week we'll pick up. I can't answer that. That's a good question. All right, so it's very similar then. And the only difference is this betrothal was a contractual covenant relationship. You could not break it except by divorce, and you had to have reason for divorce. Yeah.